Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? Today we're speaking with Dr. Susan Toll. She's a superstar in the field of bioethics. She's a practicing internist in the Division of General Medicine and Geriatrics at OHSU, and in 2014 received the McLean Prize in Clinical Medical Ethics. Dr. Toll, welcome to KABU.
Tom, it's great to be here.
As I understand it, you created a program, a system that's known as the Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment Program. You call this PULSED. What is the program, and how does it relate to advanced directives that we may already have? Why would I need the two things?
That's an excellent question, Tom. People often wonder, why do I need two documents? I already have an advanced directive. Perhaps they filled it out talking with their families. Perhaps they filled it out with their lawyer. And it talks about what they would and would not want in certain circumstances in the future. Things they often don't have now. But if those things were to happen, there are treatments they want and maybe some treatments they don't. The wonderful thing about an advanced directive is it's a great conversation tool with your family to help you talk about what really matters to you. And it allows you to appoint someone, legally appoint them, to make decisions if you're so sick you can't make decisions for yourself. If you're in a bad car accident, if something happens and you can't speak for yourself, an advanced directive is a very helpful tool, and certainly we encourage all adults to have one. PULSED isn't for everybody. It's very different. It's for people nearing the end of their lives. And it's for people who are ready to say, I'm not talking about the future anymore. I'm talking about tonight. If I collapse and emergency medicine personnel come running in here, there are some treatments I want and there are some treatments I don't want, and I mean it today. Then you're ready to take your advance directive and turn it into action with medical orders.
So if I understand correctly, an advanced directive can be sort of a strategic thing that's requires some interpretation, whereas a PULSED is very specific. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And one is a philosophical guide, and the other, the PULSED, Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, the word orders means it's medical orders. So it gives specific orders to do or not do certain medical treatments in a crisis. And the orders are to other healthcare professionals so that, for example, emergency medical personnel know exactly what treatments to give and which ones not to give. And it's the only way they can avoid giving them in a crisis is to have specific orders not to.
I see. So the term medical orders is really what controls the situation. It's very clear to them, and they are not taking responsibility for making a decision to do it or not to do it. It's an order, and they're implementing that order.
Exactly. They and other healthcare professionals who don't know you, but as you maybe are in a different hospital and health system from the one that cares for you, also honor these orders unless they have new information from family, from somewhere, that says otherwise. It gives them a starting place that isn't always due.
By the way, I do see, and I didn't realize it until you came today, Doctor, that you have a very specific form. It's a two-page form. I'm holding a copy of it. It's front and back. It's pink in color. It really gets your attention. And it's got the specific kinds of subjects that this document covers. Tell us, what are the typical subjects or provisions that are in this agreement?
Well, this is indeed for people who are nearing the end of their lives. This is not for everybody. And we are turning your wishes into action with medical orders. And as we do that, we ask a couple of very basic questions. If your heart stops, do you want us to attempt to restart it? People often think, because they maybe have watched television, that we're likely to be able to get their heart restarted. But for people who are living in a nursing home, are frail, the rate of being able to get your heart restarted is about 3 in 100. It's very low. And that doesn't mean that you're as good as new. It means we just got your heart restarted.
So your heart may be damaged and your ribs may be damaged and a lot of other things may be damaged.
People are particularly worried about whether or not the brain missed oxygen for too long. And that is a kind of impairment that many are worried about. If your heart stops and you're not breathing, something serious medical happened to cause that. Just restarting your heart may not fix what that problem was. And that is very serious if you're already frail and very ill.
Do you need lawyers to be involved in this, in the preparation of this agreement, doctor?
To complete medical orders, the PULSE form, you need to work with your healthcare professional. These are medical orders, so a physician or an advanced practice nurse would work with you and sign them after talking with you and being sure what your wishes are. A lawyer would not write medical orders, but might be very helpful as part of your estate planning in helping you with your advance directive.
Should people prepare the PULSE when they're healthy and not wait until they're in an intensive care or near-death situation?
No. A PULSE form is for people who are very sick. If you fill out a PULSE form and you're healthy, you would have orders to have everything done. Well, that's what medicine is going to do anyway. That is the default. That's why PULSE was created. The only way to overcome the default of all medical treatments are provided in a crisis is to have orders to limit some of them.
Why was this needed? It seems like a breakthrough, but why? How did it? What was the occasion that made this come about?
One of the most common things we were seeing in the early 1990s when we developed the PULSE program was people being transferred with advanced dementia and pneumonia from nursing homes and ending up on breathing machines in intensive care. Family weren't with them at the time, and they couldn't provide medical information. And family would come in and say, "What on earth are you doing? Mom wouldn't want this," as they were in the intensive care unit on a breathing machine. It made us realize that orders in the nursing home weren't being transported, weren't being honored outside the nursing home. The ambulance personnel couldn't honor them. The emergency department personnel couldn't honor them if they could find them. And so a system was needed where you had a thoughtful conversation in one place and it could be honored across settings of care.
I guess it takes me back to something you said earlier, that this is a very specific kind of directive. It's not the overview or the long-term thinking that you find in an advanced directive or even in a do not resuscitate document. It's really specific to certain situations and treatments.
And it's very specific to the situation of that individual at that time.
Right.
So what kinds of health problems do you have? What are you likely facing? If you're on oxygen and you have bad heart disease or bad lung disease, you get the flu, and the chance that the question of a breathing machine is going to come up is very real. Do you want that or do you not want that? This document allows you to say, if you're to a place you would not want it, that you don't.
Could this document cover feeding tubes and forced feeding, that sort of thing?
This document allows people to say in advance, because it was initially written with Alzheimer's patients in mind as one of the groups to help, because those people could no longer speak for themselves. And pneumonia was so common in that group of patients. And so this document allows a decision not to have a permanent feeding tube placed, but does not allow those who can eat, if assisted, to be prohibited from that happening. It's about true medical treatments, such as artificial feeding by tube.
Which doctor works with the patient? Is it the oncologist, the primary caregiver, or another specialist in preparation of this agreement or in execution?
To complete a PULSE form, it does require a healthcare professional to sign it with you to write medical orders that other people can honor and follow. More often than not, it's your primary care doctor, but you might be going regularly to see a cancer doctor, and it might be your oncologist. You might have kidney disease, and it might be your nephrologist. But most of the time, it's primary care.
What role does the family of the patient play in executing and implementing the agreement, or do they necessarily play a role?
Well, first of all, family benefit enormously the more they know about what you want. If they feel very clear about what you want, if you've appointed a surrogate and they actually have legal authority to speak for you, and they know what you would want, they can get your PULSE form signed. They can be sure your wishes are honored. And not only that, but they could get a document changed if maybe you got sicker and there are more treatments you wouldn't want now, but you did a couple of months ago.
So the family, in a way, benefits from this by being more secure in its decision-making. Is that right?
Absolutely, and by being more sure that the wishes will be honored.
Does this exist only in Oregon? What about Washington and other states?
Oregon is one state that developed the Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment program, but all states are now developing a program. Over 20 have very active programs statewide, and soon we think it will be used completely across the United States. It's increasingly becoming available.
I'm about to go back to Maryland. If I had this, would a doctor honor it, even if it weren't a Maryland form, or does it have to be something they have in their own state?
When we have Oregon patients go to other states, when they're in a hospital emergency department, we've had excellent success honoring them. If it's in a home and emergency medical personnel come, because it may not match the protocols, they may have to actually take you to the hospital before it would be honored.
Mm. There's a reference here to a place where you keep these, or a place where they're registered in some way. Where is that, and how does that registration work?
Oregon has a statewide electronic registry system, and as long as the patient wants their form to be in the registry, you can opt out, a few people do, then the person who signed the form is expected to submit it for you to the registry. The registry is a 24/7 service that provides information to emergency personnel, to emergency departments, to EMTs in the field, and can be sure that your form is where it's needed in a time of crisis.
So if you're known to have one of these, then a physician at your bedside could theoretically contact the registry and obtain a copy of this. Is that right?
Absolutely. And if they're in certain kinds of electronic record systems, they just can see it online.
Doctor, you recently wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, a year ago, it was published, and I think you contended that patients in Oregon are less likely to receive intensive care and more likely to receive hospice care at end of life than patients in other states. Is this the result of this program, of the PULSED program?
The PULSED program is one component of many different things that have happened in Oregon. Extensive education, overcoming some systems problems that made it difficult to have wishes honored. There are many factors at work, but the net result is Oregonians who wish to stay near the end of life at home and die in their own bed are more likely to do so than in other states.
Well, this has been very helpful, Doctor. I would ask you one other thing. You're the chair of the bioethics department, is that right, at OHSU?
I direct the Center for Ethics in Healthcare.
What do you deal with besides these kinds of issues? What are the major bioethics issues that come up?
There are dozens and dozens and more all of the time. There are many issues that relate, for example, to conflict of interest. What are the incentives in medicine? How did we get where we are with the opioid epidemic, for example? There are issues about telling the whole truth. What happens if a medical mistake is made? How honest are we? The list is very long, and it makes every day something different. And there is plenty to work on in healthcare, as there are so many changes with our technology and what we can do. And the tougher questions often are, should we?
I think of a bioethicist as kind of a philosopher.
There's philosophy, there's religion, there's what can medicine do, there are the perspectives of all of the different healthcare disciplines. It's just like creating the PULSED program. A lot of great minds need to come together and try to solve some of the challenges we're facing today.
Do you have any guiding lights for how you handle these kinds of complicated decisions? Anything you can share with us?
Well, one thing I'd like to share is that for people who want a lot more information about planning near the end of life, we have a website with lots of resources, short videos, printed materials that can help you and your family. And you go to OregonPULSED.org. No periods, no dots, no anything. Just run Oregon and Pulse together.org. And the website provides a vast amount of information and examples. One video, for example, is called PULSED, When Advanced Directives is Not Enough. And it really shows you why an advanced directive alone might not get you what you want near the end of your life. That is the YouTube video, and there are a number of other videos, but they're all easily found on that website.
All right, Doctor. Is there anything I should have asked you about or you would like to mention that I didn't bring up?
I would encourage families to realize that everybody holds a little different view of how they want their end-of-life care to be. Most people want to be at home or a home-like setting if they now live in assisted living. But that doesn't mean they all want the same amount of medical detail about what's happening with them. They may or may not want complete control and follow everything I outlined in my advance directive, or they may want to give the family more discretion. And they, while they would have wanted life support stopped for themselves, may say, but if it's better for the family to let everyone get here, it's okay with me to go a little longer if it helps my kids. People say things differently. It's why you need to have conversations with those you love. Because we're not all the same, and we value certain things more for one person than another. It needs to be all about the person you are at this point in your life and how you want to live life's last chapter.
Dr. Susan Toll, thanks for coming to KBOO today, and thanks for all you do.
You are most welcome, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Here's Howard Schneider, a writer and publisher whom I met at the Hollywood Senior Center. I asked Howard, is Portland a good place in which to get old?
For me, it has been, and for most of the people I know in my age bracket, Portland is good because it seems that there is no discrimination just because you happen to be elderly. It seems more what you do and who you are counts more.
Howard, you're a publisher, is that right? Or
yes, a publisher and a writer.
So you don't find discrimination. You don't find that millennials, or whatever those young people are called, are edging us out?
Wow, that's a good question. Edging us out of what?
Housing.
Of housing?
Parking spaces. Hmm. Inexpensive meals, whatever.
I often wonder at how people afford to eat out so frequently in this town, and a lot of them are younger. I think we older people don't have as much disposable income on average, so it's not the fact that we're being edged out, but I think the fact is that we are not as we don't have as much disposable income to be able to afford to eat out in all those nice restaurants. I don't feel we're being edged out in any purposeful manner. It's up to us to make our own places here in our society.
How about housing, Howard? I mean, I see 20, 30, 40-unit buildings going up all over town, around Burnside here in Southeast, and right over here on near the metro station.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of that. And I know that the sales prices or rents or whatever they are going to be really high. And I hear older people saying, I can't afford to live here because I can't afford housing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that happening? Do you see that?
I see it, yes, but I also hear young people saying the same thing. I'm not so sure it's just an issue of being elderly, although since the elderly do have less disposable income, it's going to impact us more. But it's a dilemma. We love this town, a lot of other people too, also love it, and they're coming here, and they have to live someplace.
What is it that you like most about Portland?
We moved here 12 years ago from the East Coast, from New England, where we had lived 35 years. We loved New England, but we also love Portland for many of the same reasons. We find the people are interesting. There's a lot of mental as well as artistic activity here. It's easy to relate to people. People seem extremely friendly. I haven't run across any issues of discrimination. As I said earlier, I feel welcome. We live in a wonderful neighborhood, and all the neighbors are nice. It's a good place to be.
Do you mind if I ask what neighborhood you live in?
We live in Northeast, in Irvington.
Okay, so you named some really good things about being in the city. You've been here for 12 years, so you've been here long enough to know it and feel it. You're a book publisher, is that right?
Yes, a friend of mine and I, Redwood La Chapelle, who I met in one of our flash writing groups, and I, about 3 years, decided to start a publishing company through which we could publish our own short stories as well as to help other people, especially older people, publish their work. We have found that many of us, older people, aren't as familiar with the technologies, the computers, the internet, all of that, that would allow easier self-publication. So we learned it ourselves, and we're facilitating that for other people.
That's Mr. Howard Schneider. Anything I should have asked you that you would like to mention, Howard, about being old in Portland?
It's good to be old any place, as long as you keep healthy.
Does that mean you exercise regularly?
I exercise regularly, and my wife keeps me on a good diet. And I think the other thing is that keeping busy both physically and intellectually is critical. Another reason I like Portland is because of the sense of creativity. I find it every place. My wife is a musician and a vocalist and a ukulele player. And she has so many opportunities, whether to be singing or playing with new groups. It's endless. Same thing for writing. I've never met so many writers in my life in one place. Artists, potists, it's in the air.
It's in the air? Okay, Howard, we'll take your word for that. Now here's Lee Radovich, 86 years young, living in the same Portland house for the past 61 years. She's talking about the Village Movement, one of the most important neighborhood-based activities in Portland, and the subject of episode 19 of Retired or Rewired. Hello, Lee. Tell us about your village.
Well, I live in River West Village. And it goes from the river clear up to Shoals Ferry Road, which is past Garden Home, and from the south down by Boone's Ferry up to about Highway 26.
How long have you been in that village?
We just went live last October to provide services, but they've been meeting for about 3 or 4 years, and each village has an own governing council. I am a volunteer, and so I have been asked to help out a lady that is confined to a walker. So I have helped with light housekeeping there in her home, and that's lovely. And that's all coordinated through the organization.
Lee, did you tell me you've been in your house for 61 years?
I have been in my home, actually, since 1956, and I hope that I can be there for a number more years.
Is the primary purpose of the villages to give people the opportunity to stay in their homes?
That's one of the main reasons that people get connected with the village, but also older people like to feel that they're valuable, that they can provide a service, and so a lot of our villagers enjoy volunteering and helping other people out. So that's another good reason. But it is wonderful to feel that you're acquainted with this group of people who have been vetted. They have had background checks, and they're interested in helping other people.
So I gather that while you help someone now by light housekeeping and whatever else you do, at some point you might need some help from somebody else.
And I have had some services already.
Right. Okay.
One thing, my computer got a problem, so when I pushed on the right shift, why, the whole page flew off to the right. And I had a son-in-law come over and work on it for half an hour with no luck. And so I talked to the villages, and one fellow came over and solved my problem. He had to work about half an hour, but yeah. he was about my age.
Thanks, Lee. You'll hear more from her in episode 19 of Retired or Rewired. And next week, we'll be talking with Vicky Kind, a nationally known gerontologist who's written about how to help caregivers do their job. You've been listening to our series on aging in Portland, Retired or Rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.